Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
And gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Creasy! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
Hello once again, and it's another week of American Tennis. I am Coach Chuck Creasy, and every week on Wednesdays at noon, we have American Tennis. That is Eastern Standard Time, 2 hours from right now on the UR Tennis Network as well. Jason Haynes will have the American College Connection, and you'll get to listen to one of the college coaches from around the country. And we thank Jason for the UR Tennis Network, as it has been now 3 years, 4 years actually, since its inception. American Tennis has been going for 3 years. We also want to tell you that on Tuesdays, Lisa Stone has her Parenting Aces program, and Lisa's blog site, website, and all her writings really taken off. I mean, she even had an article that was taken to the Huffington Post, and it was on parents and kids and different things. And Lisa Stone's just doing a fantastic job, and good luck to her continuing your program. We have some new shows on the UR Tennis Network. There's a Florida high school program that Jason's put up. Also want to remind you that J.P. Weber, every Tuesday on the Yellow Ball Network, has his We Coach Tennis program. Now, the We Coach Tennis website is one of the most popular out there. Over 2,000 members now, I think, on his Facebook. And J.P. is something else. My golly, I just wish everybody had as much enthusiasm as that man did for the sport and for teaching and for giving to other people. And he's down there in Marietta, Georgia, and listen to his programs on Tuesday on the We Coach Tennis. I think it's Yellow Ball Network. He calls it Yellow Ball Network. And he's really been fighting that battle, so it's pretty cool. And if you want to hear a lot of things, his programs are really, really entertaining on Tuesdays. So anyhow, I want to talk about something I did here on the We Coach Tennis program, radio program yesterday, and we'll get there in a minute. But I wanted to say that, you know, for the last 3 weeks, I've been going over most of the highlights of my momentum studying and momentum control tactics. Since 1979, I have worked on a way to control momentum, not just in tennis, but in sports as well. And Actually, I've been able to give some talks to some businesses and things on this as well. And it really, momentum is a huge, huge thing. They even talk about it in some of the fantastic books out there right now. The Tipping Point is the one that comes to mind. But what exactly causes tipping point, and what causes momentum, and how do these things occur? How do these trends occur? Every tennis player knows about the power of momentum. When you have it, it's just like things work in such sync that you wish you could can it. And when it's against you, you feel like you're against a flood, a deluge coming at you, and you just feel like you're helpless. So where does this magical power come from, and can you control it? If you go back to my last three programs, the 11th of March, I believe it was the 4th of March, and then the February, the last program in February, you can go back to the UR Tennis Network, just punch that in on Google it, and it'll come up, and you can go back and see all of the episodes. But I talked about momentum the last three weeks, and what got me into that discussion was primarily all that we've been doing in battling the ITA and the civil war that we are about to have erupting here. And it's funny, I live in Charleston, South Carolina right now, and it's the number one city in America, number one place to go to in America. But we also had the start of the civil war here. Actually, Citadel cadets, they say, fired on Fort Sumter, killed a donkey or a mule, whatever the difference, if you all know what the difference is. But they didn't, nobody got killed, but that started the most horrific war in our country. We had a civil war, and we've been talking in recent weeks, in the past actually 6 months to a year, about the civil wars that are going on. And it's maybe settling down a little bit with the red, orange, green ball controversy, although on JP's show, it came up again yesterday, and it's a difference in ideologies about whether it's a great teaching tool or if it's something that should be mandated by the USTA. And this is American tennis. This is the United States of America. And if you haven't listened to me before, I'll say it once again. I believe in complete freedom. Freedom in the United States to innovate, to be an entrepreneur, to take and run with the ball, and learn how to do things in your own way. Use good guidelines, which, look, red, orange, green stuff, good teaching tool, great teaching tool, but got my dander up when they mandated this stuff. I just dislike that. And then the ITA, of course, there, and I'll just say it, my golly, bullying, arrogance, all of the things that they've done this past 3 years to ramrod and push forward this no-ad scoring thing, which is an abomination that none of the players want. The coaches don't want, none of the players really, when you talk about 88% of the players not wanting something, I'd say none. The 12% who might have voted for it, I've heard many of the players say that they were afraid to vote differently, the coaches were pushing them to. But on the women's side, it's like three-fourths, 74% of the women. Coaches do not want this, and for good reason. In women's tennis, you have to construct points. It's not just slap ball. I call it slap ball or just ball striking tennis. It's just like watching NBA basketball where there's no construction, you know, of points or anything. And indoor slap tennis where it serves and nerves. A lot of the coaches in the men's side up north like this because it leads to some skewed results and some fast results. We've had some Ivy League teams. No offense to you guys if you're listening out there, but we've had some Ivy League teams for the first time in about 30 years do worth a flip and try to start winning some matches that probably they haven't won in 30 years. It's been about, I'm trying to think, I think there's only three teams in the history of some of these very northern teams that play all indoor tennis that have made the round of 16 at the NCAAs, that it's always played outside where you have to construct points. It's not slap ball points. And there's good reason why we have... Um, you know, our game is founded with so many tools being needed, but the center of the game has always been point construction instead of slapping balls. So enough of that, but we came up 2 weeks ago with a great 10 reasons why not, or why NOAAD is a no-go. And, you know, and if you'd like to see that, go to my website. ChuckCreasy.net is my website. ChuckCreasy.net, you can get information on my camps. My six books that I've written are up there, and you can order those on Amazon and all that. Coaching Tennis is the one that's probably the one out there that's most complete. Coaching Tennis, 1997, it's still, I wouldn't change much of it except about 10%, but Momentum Control, Shot Selection, Tactics, the physical, the mental, the emotional parts are all touched upon in that book. My camps are up there. The things I'm working with coaches, seminars that I'm doing, and those things are all on ChuckCreasy.net. So anyhow, this is American Tennis. I'm Coach Chuck Creasy. Every week you can come on the show if you would want to. Also, if you call area code 714-583-6853, area code 714-583-6853. Our mission is to stand up and speak out. As an American, this is your duty. It's your obligation. It's not just a privilege or a right. It's something that you need to do absolutely positively. Because Edmund Burke said that all that it takes for evil to prosper is for good men to do nothing. And you have a duty to do this. And as much as socialism is being bled into our system, as much as it's being bled in, please remember that it is your duty and your right. It's your right and your privilege, but it's also your duty and your obligation to speak out. But area code 714-583-6853. And if you're calling in, just hold the line and we'll get to you. You can listen to the show as well. We'll take most of our callers here in the second half. But let me talk to you here a couple things. First of all, I want to, if you've been following the results out at Indian Wells, my golly, it's coming around a little bit there. I think Donald Young's having a good tournament. Jack Sock, it looks like he may be having a breakout tournament. And golly, I know he's had some family tragedy there and some tough things happened. And if everybody's wondering what happened to him, the man, a former professional player we're going to have coming on here later today, we'll be able to tell the story. But I think he's been through some tough, tough times. And a lot of times when stuff happens to you at a deep level where you have some illness or some sickness in the family or something happens, my golly, you count your blessings one by one by one, and you're happy to play tennis instead of feeling like you are the privileged one. You feel like it is a privilege to play. But Steve Johnson continues to do pretty well. But there are some players that look like they're about ready to break out. And I wanted to talk today about something, a concept I heard on J.P. Weber's We Coach Tennis program yesterday. J.P. Weber was talking very simply. He's been on a bandwagon recently and just saying, look, USTA, guys, you need to separate the difference between participation and performance. If you've gone to their website, I don't know if I've ever seen a bigger cluster mess, you know, and I've been in tennis for 50 years now, and boy, I have a hard time going through that and trying to figure out what's what. They need to just have two buttons, one that says performance, or serious tennis. No, you can't say that because everybody thinks they're serious players. I've just been watching this morning a ladies' league. And if you want to see people that are intense, these ladies' leagues are something else. Everybody's, even a weekend warrior, the over-the-hill 45-year-old guy is playing in a Friday evening or Sunday afternoon league, he thinks that he's a serious tennis player. But, you know, the point is we need a split between performance areas and participation areas. And JP said, yeah, in participation tennis, go ahead, you know, use that NOAAD scoring, use the Hoochie Coochie Show, use four game sets, use whatever, but don't dumb down performance areas where kids have to learn the game. And as an educator, this is what I have always is appalled me. I once wrote an article, I was deluded, polluted, and prostituted the greatest game in the world. This is awful. So anyhow, this got me thinking about the show today, and I've got a professional player coming on here on the show to talk about his experience and really in future and challenger level tennis, and you know what he thinks some things would help with the performance areas. But the name of the show today is the pathway to excellence or the doorway to participation. Now, this is the point, and it's an ideology thing. And I said this on J.P. Weber's program one time, that there is an ideology of socialism out there where everybody wants everybody to have a chance no matter who. And that's all good. Everybody should have a door open with a chance, but nobody should have a right to a finishing area. Nobody should have a right to getting trophies, no matter what, participation trophies. Nobody should continue to get awards for mediocrity if they're really in a performance area. So we want to talk about these two in the pathway today. And so I'm going to go through this a little bit pretty quickly here, and then I want to go on and try to take some callers. But let's face it, performance or participation all starts in the same place. We take our kids out like I do every Monday. I take my youngsters out, and I teach some seven-year-olds. And I've got a 11, 9, and 7-year-old youngster. I've got 11-year-old daughter, 9-year-old son, 7-year-old daughter, and they're all doing the same thing. And people might say, oh, my golly, your 11-year-old, she's behind. And I'm saying, no, this is the first time I've seen her. She said, Papa, can I hit some tennis balls with you? First time this week, you know, I've been taking her out to the courts for a lot of years, but she said, Papa, I would like to hit some tennis balls. And I walked on over, and this is a thing that I learned from the great Dick Leach, and also it was also taught to me by in the book that the Bryan brothers, that Wayne Bryan has out. He says, always stop before your kids are ready to stop. So we were hitting along, and I was getting a buzz, just hitting a few balls with my daughter. And she's, of course, she's got her strokes down a little bit. I teach them two hands on both sides from the start, by the way, with big rackets. And some of you pros are going to cringe when you hear this, but I use heavy rackets even for my seven-year-olds. And I let them cock the wrist up and just let two hands on both sides and let the racket drop. And the momentum of the swing, and boy, it's a beautiful stroke on both sides. So I went out, my daughter's just rallying and rallying. We rallied for 15 minutes. I said, that's all, honey. And she goes, oh, a little bit more, Papa. I said, no, we're going to go over here. And I quit right before she wanted to, and it was tough on me as a father. But I just quit with her still wanting more. And this is an important, important thing. So what we do on Mondays is we make it a nice outing, and we have fun out there with our family and a couple other kids that we teach, and then we usually have a pizza or a hamburger or something, and it's a family afternoon. Now, everybody, any player that's ever been really good starts sort of like this. Now, very quickly, if the kids start to show promise and they're keeping score and they start playing sets, of course, there's entry-level competition. Now, you still haven't divided the kids into performance or to participation. But this entry-level competition then, it sort of the proof's in the pudding a little bit. I was with a former number one player of mine, team captain Brad Emmendorfer, this past weekend, and I had him speaking to some of my players, and he was speaking about how it took him about 11 months to get his first win in a tournament. And so he had the endurance to be able to get smacked and get up off the ground, get smacked, get up off the ground, and to continue to play. Well, sometimes when kids lose, they quit, and sometimes they don't. And that's just the way it is. And they will take to different sports. Right now, all of my children are playing at least three sports, are involved in swimming. They're doing tennis. They're doing, my son's doing basketball now. And they're doing all these different sports and getting a taste for it. And guess what? My son, my daughters will decide which route they want to go with their sports. And if they are in love with tennis, boy, I will be happy. But if they're not, they're not. Now, pretty soon what will happen after they get to the level where they compete a little bit is that they will start drifting towards, no, I just want to have fun with it, and we'll keep doing the fun thing with her. And they'll be in participation. Now, listen, participation does not breed excellence, but excellence will always breed participation. Have you ever noticed the little vacuums of tennis, or the hot spots of tennis, or the gold mine effects of tennis? The Gold Mine Effect is a great book out there, folks. But once you have two or three excellent kids in an area, it breeds 10, then there's 20, then there's 50. And then pretty soon you have an area that's known for its tennis throughout the country. And this is how it happens. Excellence breeds participation. But the USTA's got it wrong when they talk about participation breeding excellence, that just the cream will rise. That's not true. And what J.P. Weber was saying so well yesterday was the fact that with tennis, if you just keep the kids at participation, dumbed down half sets, abbreviated sets, 10-point tiebreakers, all of this dumbed down stuff that infuriates a coach when a coach is trying to teach trigonometry and high-level math, then you have the administration saying, no, you've got to teach to the lowest kid here. You cannot teach that advanced stuff. You have to teach to the lowest kid. This is what infuriates coaches. We should all be speaking to the king and the queen and our youngsters. Now, with my children, yeah, they're still in that participation area, and that's the deal with them. But guess what? My son already starting in baseball, he just got a call, and he might get to do this summer travel league in baseball. Like, wow, now I can maybe go play tournaments at a different city. Wow, okay, now he's on fire for baseball. He's not on fire for tennis. So we've got to make a decision as parents. If we go to this summer travel league, now, he's just crossed over into the competition or the performance, or they call high performance, just a coin name, but just the performance level of the deal. And my son now will decide, hey, I like winning, I hate losing, I'm going to get better. If he sort of says there's a hodgepodge in between, not much happens. If he sort of stays in the middle, not much happens at all, and it'll be a dumb down. This is where if they start playing the hokey pokey show and they start playing these dumb down sets, the tiebreakers for the third set, this is where it gets really aggravating. I don't want my son to get participation trophies in baseball. He actually gave one back to the people. They were passing a trophy out to the whole team, and he gave it back. I was so proud of him. It was awesome. And, this was the first year. It's last year they won. They finished second in a little tournament. These are 9-year-old kids, and they finished second in a tournament, and all the kids got these little trophies. He goes, Papa, look at the trophy I got. But, Papa, it was not a participation trophy. And do I have to get – I said, no, son, you earn that second. Okay. But, you know, I didn't want to tell him, I've known parents who've had their – children throw away the second place trophies, but no, he's got that and he's proud of it. The participation ones drop off. Now, here's where J.P. Weber's right on. Competition versus league play and things. You need to have this breakdown. And in the breakdown, all we're saying to the USTA is, look, make a thing. You click on participation events, click on competitive events. And this is where they're having a trouble with ideology. And the reason why, anyone out there can speculate, it might be that we have a lot of participation people running our competitive events. We might have the 3.5 player or the player that's never participated on panels or on committees or on things, and their whole mentality is for kumbaya. Let's everybody participate. Let's everybody have a nice time. Let's everybody, don't push the kids, give everybody a trophy, and participation will breed excellence. And that's where we need to make the split. J.P. Weber's right away. The league events, and the kids who go to leagues and play high school for fun, this is okay. High school, let's face it, it's been dumbed down to an after-school activity. You know, is it a sport or is it an after-school activity? Is it the look? If it was music, is it the orchestra or is it the band? You know, I mean, there's a big difference between the orchestra and the band. An orchestra, you got people that are trying to do something with their musical talents. In the band, it's a participation activity. Doesn't mean that orchestra members don't play in the band. It doesn't mean the band members can't go to the orchestra. But there's a big difference. Are you hearing me there on this one? And I'm going to get some comments. The switchboard is lighting up here. The abbreviated stuff, though, played in league tennis. It can be played in the college tennis clubs. In some of the high school events, I'm against it being played in high school participation, but that's sort of where we're at. That's a whole other story. If you go down to Texas, folks, you've got great high school events down there. What they do is they do a short team season in the fall, and then they play tournaments the rest of the year. So you got your participation. If for those kids who want to just play team sport, and then you got your serious players with an avenue to play all spring. Now, look, D3 tennis is sort of that way. It's competitive, and the kids try hard, but it takes a back seat, I think, to probably D1 tennis and things, because that's more the cutthroat and it's more of the high performance. Now, what is the way or what is the route that you take with the high performance? And that's where we want to get to. And I want to make one last comment. Look, this is different for everybody. And I'll tell you a couple quick stories. I used to have a player on my team in early, late 70s, early 80s, Mark Dixon. Mark has got to, I think, 12 in the world, 7 in the world in doubles, great player. But my golly, Mark, you know, used to take losses to people. He would lose to like a 6 guy after he was an All-American as a sophomore, but he would lose to like a player's like 6 on the team, somebody else, and I'd be like infuriated. And Mark could say, "I'm okay, Coach. I know where I'm going. Coach, I'm okay. I know where I'm going." And then he would, a week later, turn the thing around, and he'd beat a great player from a number one player from somewhere else. He would take these bad losses, he'd get great wins, but he always said, "Coach, I know where I'm going. I know what I'm doing." And he always sort of had it in his mind he was going to play pro tennis, as did someone like a Brian Gottfried, who was trained early years, did well. And he had his whole career was like that. But on the other hand, I remember so well being at the Orange Bowl in the 76, 77 in there. And I remember John McEnroe there being a junior. He was 16 or something. And he was so upset talking to his buddy and saying, "I could have gotten an ATP point up there in Chattanooga," I think it was. "And I lost this match and I had a match point, but it didn't work out, and I could have had my first or second ATP point." And then 8 months later, 9 months later, he's making the daggone semifinals of Wimbledon, and you know, the whole perspective, you know, changed there. And for some players, the light just goes on at a certain time. Other players always have it on. My children, they're 11, 9, and 7, and you know what? My daughter, if her light doesn't go on till 14. Some people might say, "Oh, it's too late. No, it's not. The light goes on for the kid when the light goes on, and that's sort of the way it is. So anyhow, I want to take a commercial break real quick. We'll be right back with American Tennis. This is Coach Chuck Creese, and I'll take the callers here in a minute.
This is Coach J.P. Weber of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. In my 30 years' experience in coaching tennis, I've never seen a better tennis training situation for children than Coach Creasy's Total Tennis Training Camps. Chuck Creasy has coached them and trained them in every arena, from juniors to collegiate to professional tennis, and over 15,000 children have improved their games at his summer tennis camps. Find out more at chuckcreasy.net. That's chuckcreasy.net.
And this is Coach Chuck Creasy, and I'd like to tell you about our 2015 summer tennis camp. And all you have to do is go to chuckcreasy.net, and you can sign up right now in late July. We only have 2 weeks this summer, folks. It's going to be in late July, the last 2 weeks of the summer. And Sign up at chuckcreasy.net. American Tennis every Wednesday at noon, and we're talking about the pathway to excellence and high performance, or the doorway to participation. Thanks for hanging on there. Area code 864918. Would you like to be on the show today here? Area code 864, are you there?
Yes, Coach.
Yeah, hey. Yeah, who's this,
Doug,
please?
Doug Pilot, how you doing?
Doug, man, you're. Thanks for calling in, man. That's awesome. I surely appreciate you calling in. And there's very few people in the country, listeners, who would know more about the pathway to excellence or participation other than Doug Pilot. Doug, you yourself were a gold ball winner in junior tennis, one of the best college players in the land. And now you have a daughter, I believe, that is number one in the country. Is that correct?
She was one in the country in 14 for 2014, and then she's playing 14s now, turns 13 in a couple months. So, yeah, she was won a gold ball at the Winter Nationals, won a doubles gold ball a year ago. So she's obviously on the performance pathway. My older daughter, they started together, played tournaments, just like you were talking about on your show, and she has gone the participation route. She, I think, may play high school tennis. She may not. You are correct about high school tennis in Texas. You can be a little more casual about it, and there are some serious people also playing high school tennis, because it's all year round here in Texas. So saying that, I basically have two daughters that are going opposite paths, and completely understand what you're saying. I do agree with you on just about everything you've said, and it's a different path. It's a different coaching. It's a different everything.
Where's our problem, Doug, in the country? Where's our problem? I heard so much now. They gave gold balls away for team members at the team event in Mobile, Alabama. I heard J.P. Weber speak about this. Where are we goofing up here?
Well, I think that they've taken the gold ball, which was for junior tennis, just ultimate, and they kind of dumbed it down. They downgraded it. I don't think – look, the team event in Mobile, I was there. The parents loved it. The kids loved it. It was a really neat event, okay? It should not be a gold ball event. It should be a team event, and if you want to give it a trophy with a Davis Cup, with a plaque, or with all the team names and make it something different, that's fine. I don't have a problem. I don't think it should be a gold ball event. And if they want to give it a lot of points, fine. Look, the point system isn't working, okay? It's hurt local tournaments because my daughter can't play local tournaments. She's got to go play the point tournaments so she can get in the big tournaments. So they've hurt local tournaments. The ranking system obviously isn't correct. It's way off from when I grew
That's
up.
That's for sure. So they, as a college coach, I Doug is a college coach. I never look at the rankings. You see a kid that's 18 in the country, and he's really not 18. He might be 98, and the 98 kid might be 18.
Right.
And
right.
it's really, so, you know, it's – so go ahead, Doug.
So I think that they need to fix the schedule, the tournament schedule. They need to fix the point thing. They need to fix some things on the performance side. I think on the participation side, I don't think it's going great, but I think they could do more with going into schools and gym classes and getting more people kind of using, tennis as a exercise tool, as a, you know, that's what I think. That's where I think. And I think that what's happening is that, like I told, I was sitting with Jack Sharp almost the whole week in Mobile when it was raining. And I was saying to Jack, you know, the parents love this and the kids are having a great time, but you do realize this team format is really not needed for these players. These are the top players in the country. They're in it. These people are in it. You ask 80% of these kids here, and they probably want to play pro tennis. So they don't need to give these people participation medals and, you know, dumb it down and shorten the scoring and all that stuff. They need to think about how the USTA can make performance better. So, and Jack, you know, agreed with me. He's like, yeah, all these people are in it. I mean, they're having a great time. But, you know, that tournament, like my older daughter, she loves the team stuff. She went to Zonals years ago. And she had a great – she still talks about that team format, how great it was. And she loves that type of fun, that type of atmosphere. Where my younger daughter, she loved it, but obviously she wants to, you know – she wants to win gold balls. She wants to win nationals. She wants to struggle.
Yep.
So I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm definitely dealing with it in my family, and I'm definitely seeing where it's getting mixed out there. It's getting mixed a little bit, and they, they're now requiring little kids to go through Quick Start to play yellow ball. You have to go through a certain pathway.
Yeah. And
so it's getting very expensive now. So if a child starts off and wants to play yellow ball and really jump on the bandwagon, they've got to spend a lot of money to get through the orange, you know, ROG. And that's actually a deterrent, I think, to people getting into tennis a little bit. So, you know, I think that they can add all this stuff. I think it's great. But I just think that they need to not make it so cut and dry, here are the rules. You got to play so many tournaments before you get to. So, again, that's my take on it. I'm living it with both my kids. I'm glad they both are playing tennis. My older one decides she's going to, because she's a big dancer, wants to just skip high school tennis and do dance, that's fine too. So, again, that's kind of where we're at. So I agree with your point. And Mobile, I thought, was not worth the money. That's
right. And Doug, this fits in. I hope you can stay on. Can you stay online a few minutes and talk? Because you were one of the best college players in America as well, and one of the top juniors. You had somewhat of a pro career a little bit, and I don't, you know, I'm not familiar enough to say, but I've got our next guest here, and I want to get him on the line here. Reed Carlton. Hello,
hey, Kirk, how you doing?
Reed Carlton. Are you on? Yeah, I'm great. Listen, we got Doug Pilot on the line as well. Doug, Reed just graduated from Duke as number one doubles player in the country, number one. He actually was the last college player to beat Steven Johnson, and is top, you know, I think you're top 10 in the country, Reed, and at Duke, a great player, great competitor, traveled for 3 years, and you spoke a lot of times about the difference, you know, about college, and I want to bring you in on this too, Doug. You went in the 80s, and the 80s were really the heyday of college tennis. People, in trying to promote this no-ad scoring, they said, well, we played in the 80s, and we had a lot of players turn out. But I want you to compare your experience a little bit to Reed's. I'll let Reed talk here a second. But, Reed, if you could, you know, the dumb-down definitely has affected college for your training, and also some of the things that might could have given you a better chance in the pros. Go ahead if you could elaborate on a little bit with your situation.
Well, I just think, you know, in terms of hours on the court, it's really hard in college to get the necessary hours that you need, you know, if you really want to play pro tennis, especially to build your body for the wear and tear. You know, I think that is one of the possible benefits of going to college. You know, you can build your body to be ready for that wear and tear. But again, it's very hard to get those hours on the court. I try to do as many individuals as I could. Team practices are okay, but again, I think it's very hard to get the necessary work in, coupled with the new, I don't know how new they are, but, you know, just the dates. We only have 25 dates, so you only get to play maybe 30 or 40 matches in that year. So I think it's very hard to springboard from college into the pros, you know, having limits on your practice time as well as matches.
Doug, you got a lot more. I mean, I remember the 80s, we turned out a lot of pros. And 25 matches is sort of laughable, isn't it? I mean, and you're, as far as trying to be a pro,
well,
you go to college?
Well, here's my philosophy on it. If you look at when I grew up in the 80s, I almost went to Clemson. And I went to, you know, UT, and we played a ton. And I know I wish I would have played more. The singles and doubles was 2 out of 3 sets. Yes, it was no ad. But we played full matches. So not only did we play 50, 60 matches, and I know, Coach, you guys played a ton, the matches were full matches. So the only negative, I would say, was the no ad, but as far as match play, we played a bunch. Now, saying my philosophy, you know, my younger daughter is doing well, and she plays 120 matches a year. I mean, she's playing a lot of matches. People say, well, are you overplaying her? And my response is, people that want to be great at something need to compete. And, yes, you can work on your game and then go use it in the match. So, for instance, if we work a week on a second serve because my second serve was really weak, well, let's see you use it in the match. You know, I mean, let's see you go do it. Let's see if you have the courage to hit the ball when you need to hit the ball. So, I believe that is a huge deterrent. Obviously, the limited number of matches, the shortened scoring, which means you're playing less competitive time on the court. You know, people don't understand that match play is the best practice, and you're really focused and concentrating better than you do in practice. I still think you hear of Agassi and Connors, how they worked really hard in practice. I still think there was a notch up in matches. I don't know that for sure, but I just feel that no matter how hard you try in practice, it's still another notch when you go out to play a match. Do you guys agree? Or anyway, saying
well,
like
sure,
that,
Reed. Reed, go ahead, jump in there. First of all, Reed, I hear a lot of wind or something in the phone there. Could you sort of get if you can there? I think that's better. Go ahead, Reed. What are your thoughts here? You had one time, by the way, we had you on about a year and a half ago, right when you turned pro, or 2 years ago when you first turned pro. Your show is still one of the most listened to shows, and it was about an aspiring top young player trying to go into the professional ranks. So everybody will want to hear what you have to say. Talk about your frustrations, not just in college, but also then in, you know, look, people help you when they can and all that stuff. We're not talking about, hey, USTA could have helped me there. But how could our structure be better for the performance players to advance? Go ahead.
I mean, I think, just going back to what Doug said real quick, in terms of, you know, playing matches, I think, yeah, match experience is invaluable. It doesn't matter how good you feel in practice until you can do it in a match. You know, it doesn't matter. But, you know, as far as structure, you know, if you look, I know Dustin Taylor has done some work on, you know, kind of analyzing where players get their ATP points from. And I think maybe even your friend Robert Davis. You know, in Europe, they just have, if you compare Europe to the United States, you know, because, I mean, each of those countries are almost like a state in the United States, the amount of tournaments they have and the amount of points that are available for European players, it's something like 5 five or six or ten times more than the United States has, you know. So it's very hard for United States players to break through when they're predominantly playing in the United States and they have maybe a fifth the amount of tournaments to play. So it's very hard because there are a lot of very good players and a lot of very talented players playing in the United States. But, you know, it's very hard to string weeks and weeks together when you're, you know, I mean, there's every tournament, you know, the number 32 guy could win the draw or the number one seed could win the draw. So, I mean, I think in terms of just getting more futures and challengers in the United States, I think that would be a huge first step. I also think that if there could be some type of, you know, money tournament circuit, either sponsored by the USTA or, you know, we could find some big-time tennis boosters. Maybe it could even be an American-only circuit, something like that, just because, as everybody knows, the futures prize money is absolutely pitiful, and, you know, challenger prize money you can kind of make it by. But if you don't have a big-time sponsor or you're not, a top five junior in the world or winning Kalamazoo, you're probably not going to be signing any big contracts, and especially nowadays with the average age a few weeks ago of the top 100 was something like 28 years old. I don't know how they expect players to stay out long enough to give themselves a real chance to be a top 100 player. I'm not saying everybody's going to be number one, but I think there are a lot of former college players that can play, you know, to a 75 to 150 level in the world, you know, and the more players we have like that, I think the better off American tennis will be.
Well, the more participation at excellence levels will breed more excellence. But participation, and that's the point of this show and why this is exactly like what we want to talk about. Participation does not breed excellence. Now, the problem I see, guys, is that we have a lot of participation people making policy. Participation people need to butt out of making policy. 3.5 players, and just because you run a tournament, it doesn't mean that you understand tennis. And because we need to make this differentiation, that's where we're falling short. And, Reed, you said something about an American circuit only. Wouldn't that be discriminatory? What are your thoughts there, guys? Could we make an American? Listen, we're going to spend $1 billion on that daggone roof up there, a roof for 2 weeks in the U.S. Open. What we might do, come on, just take $100 million. No, let's take just 50. No, let's just take $20 million and put it to an American-only circuit, guys. USTA, come on. If I hit it on the head here, Reed? Doug, Reed, go ahead.
Yeah. This is Doug, but I can jump in. I think in the 80s when I started in the summertime, there were a lot of satellites in the summer. I mean, there was the Midwest, there was the Alabama, then there was Florida. So in the summertime, I remember Miguel Nieto and a bunch of the Clemson guys, Brian Page. So we would just go and play tournament after tournament. So there were a lot of satellites, and you could get points, I think, in the United States. Now, I haven't been following it as closely, so it's interesting what Reed is saying. And it makes sense. So I do think that you've got to start having some more circuits and more pro tournaments and more stuff in the United States. Absolutely, for sure. And that's why I think Southern California and Florida, there's a lot of good players there because they have a lot of tournaments that are close by and people don't have to travel quite as far, so they get more participation at the excellence level. So I agree with that. Now, since I haven't been following the pros satellite circuit, I'm not sure if it's a lot less than it was in the 80s. That would be interesting to find out if that is the case.
Doug, you brought up a great point. First, I want some quick stats here, but we only have 14 players, male players in the United States in the black as far as their earnings. 14 are making a living right now. Do you know we have 6,000 baseball players that are making a living? My friend Brad Emmendorfer has two young men. He was a great tennis player and a number one in the United States in the 16s, actually, and he's getting his sons into baseball. He said, Coach, he says, why would we want to play tennis? I mean, think about this. Why would you want to play tennis? Is there a payoff in college? Did you know that 90% of D2 men's scholarships go to international students? Did you know that 65% of our women's opportunities are going to international women. So, first of all, do you want your child in that arena where they might get a book scholarship when you've spent thousands and thousands of dollars? Now, secondly, can you make a living? No. Reed, is there a big difference? Futures and satellites is what Doug said too, Reed. There's a big difference what he said. Satellites sort of weeded people out. There was a litmus test and a filter that got rid of the pretenders. The contenders were standing at the Masters. The pretenders got weeded out early. Any pretender can go out and play futures.
Yeah.
Reed, could you talk to that a second? Could you talk to that a second, Reed?
Yeah, you know, I haven't played a satellite, and I'm not as familiar with satellites, you know, because the features have taken over since I've been playing. But you see these guys, you know, and they're traveling, you know, they'll play 30 weeks a year, and they're playing the qualifying, and they're acting like they're professional tennis players, but they, you know, they lose first or second round qualifying every single week, and it's just, I think that definitely, you know, cheapens the sport when anybody can kind of say, I am, you know, I'm a professional tennis player. There's no real litmus test. I mean, it's good and it's bad, but it, like you said, you know, there are a lot of pretenders out there. So it could be interesting to implement something, you know, some sort of litmus test, the way golf kind of does it with your pro card, or you know, something like that.
Right. What's the Doug, talk about satellites. You really got weeded out early, didn't you? If you didn't either win or have the guts to hang in there, right?
Yeah, I thought the satellites, except for obviously the money was not great, but the way it worked is you played, when they started, you're 4 weeks, and then you qualified for the Masters if you did well enough, and that was the fifth week. So then it went to 3 weeks, and then the fourth week was the Masters. So the way it worked is you have a series of tournaments within, you know, 6 hours or so much drive, you know, in the Midwest. And then you would do that. Then, you know, obviously, you know, I remember Roy Steppy did real well and won. Johnny Levine did real well. And then I know Brian Page got second and won. So you would get maybe 30 points if you did really well. So what it did is it made it possible for college guys to dibble in satellites in the United States, play in, you know, and then get a decent, you know, get some points. And then maybe from there, you know, I think that, I mean, 30 points would put you around back then, probably around 300 in the world or something like that. I'm not sure. But the point is that it seemed to be more doable to play in the United States, get going. It seemed like it was. Now, from according to Reed, it sounds like it's way harder now, unless you go to Europe. And I remember in Europe, they did have a lot more tournaments. But it didn't. It seems like the gap has grown way too
yep.
far now. That's what it seems like.
Yeah, the satellites. That's a great point, guys. And also, yeah, but the futures. They always say there's no future in the futures because of the way they've restructured the money and the points for the top people to stay at the top, and the entry level is not as easy. Hang on, we've got another caller here. I want to see if they have a question. The caller, Scott,
hello.
Are you on the line?
How you doing? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. You're on a speakerphone there. You're echoing a little bit, but can
I think that's
would
a problem
like
with
to...
my mic. I think there's a problem
okay.
with my microphone, yeah. So, you know, I just had a
okay.
question for the coach. By
okay.
the way, I'm a first-time caller. I'm calling for the first time. You know, I have a friend of mine who's actually trying to become, like, some sort of a player. You know, they've been training for a while. And they just have some questions about how to become like, how to improve, how to become like a better player. They're having some problems these days, you know. So I just wanted to get your opinion about that.
Okay, thanks, Scott. And guys, you guys both have played college tennis. You played junior
yeah,
tennis. You played college tennis. And
yeah,
his go ahead, Doug. You want to jump in there real quick? Hello, Doug?
Yeah. Hang
okay.
on. Yeah, Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, so Scott's question was, you know, he's got a player. Just as far as the pathway to becoming a better player, is there a set pathway? I you know, I think his question's a good one. Most people think there's some kind of magic to it, but there's hundreds of pathways, aren't there?
Yeah. Well, and that you know, that's a great question, because a lot of times everybody thinks there's one way to do it, and there isn't. You can check the top guys in the world, and I've checked the top guys, top girls, and they all kind of did things. There was not one way. And a lot of times federations think, well, there's one way to do it, and what they do is they pick the country that has the top players at the time. You know, so, and I always joke, I mean, that means we should go back to Australia where everybody used to drink Foster's, you know, between changeovers back in the 70s, you know. But, you know, so, yeah, I don't think there's definitely not one way. There's no question about it. I don't think that's, you know.
Right.
Doug,
I want to throw in, Mike Kernodle has come on the show before. He's the kinesiology and great tennis a scientist. I call him a tennis scientist, but he said, thank goodness we didn't have so many restrictions when the Fosbury flop was invented by Skip Fosbury, or thank goodness we didn't have so many restrictions when Borg was the first player that came out with a good two-handed backhand and things like that. I'm going to jump in there with Reed.
Right.
I want to ask you one more thing. Doug, we'll come back to you one more time. Maybe I hope you can hang a few more minutes. But Reed, go ahead. Listen, if you had five things that could be done to keep an aspiring professional player out there a bit longer. Doug has already said it. We've compared and contrasted college tennis in the 80s and college tennis now. Now it's been a complete dumb down. It's not a great training tool, and we already know about that. But what might the USTA do? And you know, as a suggestion and being positive here, but what might they do, or what might we do in the United States of America? You've already said maybe create an American-only circuit. What else?
I think it would be huge if they could increase the amount of dates for college players so they could get more matches in. I think that would be huge, because I think that's just a huge – it's a very deep pool of talent in college. There are a lot of really good players there. So I think, you know, address college tennis, that would be huge. An American tennis circuit, which could just help out, you know, financially for, you know, I'm not saying guys need to be making hundreds and thousands of dollars a year playing pro tournaments or money tournaments, but just enough to, you know, allow them to travel and things like that.
I also think
it would go ahead.
Just saying, keep the hope alive. Go ahead. Sorry.
Exactly. 'Cause it is just, yeah, as you know, it is very tough. I would also say, you know, I think they should have at least, you know, two or three type futures going on at one time, you know, one in California and one in Florida and another in Texas, or, you know, something like that. Because if you have, you know, one future a week, you know, it's in California or if it's in Florida, I mean, it's just, you just get a ton of really, really good players. And again, like I said, it's very hard for players to break through, you know, whereas if you were in Europe, they might have 10 or 15 futures that week, you know. So a lot of guys can get a lot of points, and then they can break through. They can get to the 200s, and then they can play challengers and break into ATPs. You know what I'm saying?
Could I jump in there real quick? A guy named Phil Whitehall,
yeah.
I heard his comment. He said, why don't we have 50 weeks a year in Florida, 50 weeks a year in California, and people could go get an apartment, and they could stay there. They didn't have to travel around so much. You know, and maybe this would be a good idea, is keep the futures on one side if you could. You know, read that. You're talking about that might work, right?
Yeah, something like that could be interesting. But again, too, I just think, you know, they have to be spread out. There should be more than one. You know, I mean, the United States
right.
is like, you know, I mean, it's almost like a continent.
Yeah,
it's huge. So,
$100 million
that
they take off. Let's take let's not put things so fancy on the shingles of that roof up there, USTA, and let's use $100 million to maybe do that. What about format? You were saying about format of college matches, too. How is that a dumb-down?
60 seconds.
Just in terms of, like we talked a little bit about earlier, in terms of number of matches played, but it's also very sad for me, too, now to be looking at a lot of these matches, and they're, you know, the first set is 7-6, and then, you know, the match is clinched, so they don't even get to finish the match. And that's happening all the time now. So in terms of development, that completely stunts development.
And team,
I know some coaches
team
don't believe.
Format.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, team format versus tournament format.
Right.
You made a comment about
I know.
Team format keeps you pigeonholed the whole year. Tournament four. You made your breakthrough, by the way, as a qualifier at the All-American tournament, didn't you?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You know, so, you know, we've talked about this in the past, too. You just kind of, especially these teams like Virginia and Southern Cal and Georgia, you know, these guys, their top six players could all be number one players at other schools. Virginia had a player who transferred this year, and he wasn't playing last year. Now he's playing number one for LSU. You know, so what does that do in terms of development for those American guys going to Virginia who have to play five and six? You know, it's just tough.
Yep. Okay, Doug, any last thoughts here? We got about 2 minutes or so. Any quick thoughts?
I like what like the show today. I thought it was good. There's definitely a difference between participation and performance, and I think we need to make sure that we do both. We work on both, and that's what I think we need to keep doing, and federations need to keep doing, focus on both.
How about let's have performance people planning performance pathways, and how about USA performance people planning performance pathways, where freedom is the biggest thing, not just cloning whatever is the best or something like that, and with restrictions. We need participation people to make it kumbaya and fun for everybody. But, you know, if they haven't got some experience in the performance end of it and taken players to the top, let's talk to the Jack Sharps, and let's talk to the daggone Doug Pilots and people. And J.P. Weber, actually, dang it, he's had a lot of players. The guy never brags, but he's got so many players that he has trained up well. But let's keep the performance people in the performance and the participation in the participation. But thanks, both you guys. We really, really appreciate it. America, born in a huddle land, raised up a family, a King James and Uncle Sam. Semper Fi tattooed on his left arm. Spent a little more in the store for a tag in the back of this USA. Won't buy nothing that he can't fix. With WD-40 and a Craftsman wrench, he ain't president. He's just made in America. Coach Chuck Creasy reminding you that you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss. And folks, hang in there and influence that young person right in front of you, and a big difference can be made for our tennis world. God bless you. See you next week.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.